Welcome to the Deloitte 2020 Global Shift podcast series, a production of Deloitte Global Services Limited. Today's program, Measuring Value, Profit in Green, looks at the intersection of three important developments in the post-crisis recovery period. We'll cover the shift in perspective in the C-suite on green growth, the perceived potential profit in green, and the associated emergence of competition. We'll also explore how these play with governments and insights on how businesses can prepare for the next 6 months and beyond. I'm Jeff Swire, and I'll be your host for today's program. Joining us today is Ken Dwoskin, Director of Deloitte China Research and Insight Center. Welcome, Ken.
Hello, Jeff. How are you today?
Very good. Thank you. In your recent piece, Measuring Value, the Profit in Green, you've identified a shift in perspective at the C-suite on green growth. You're noting that it's a shift from a compliance issue to a significant and even unavoidable strategic profit opportunity. What led to this shift?
Well, it's a good question, Jeff. We do polling on a fairly regular basis in CEO workshops and in other kinds of venues where we discuss these issues with clients. And there was a very significant shift, really, in 1 year's time from a view that much of the green growth agenda, climate change agenda, or however you come at it, was really a compliance cost issue, that companies would comply, of course, because it was required by the law and required by their sense of social responsibility, but this is something that would actually generally increase costs across the board, and that is across industries. In our more recent running of these programs and polling of executives, we've discovered that there has been a major shift, and it went through really three stages. One was the one I just described, where executives thought this is something they've got to pay for, they will do it, but it's going to cost them money, to a kind of convergence of green-related strategies, tactics, and cost management. Naturally, in the wake of the global financial crisis, given the downturn in business that many companies experienced, a new kind of more robust cost management became practice in almost every major corporation. And I think the convergence led to a discovery that actually things like a very intense look at the amount of energy consumed in various kinds of businesses, the way materials were used, the way scrap was handled and generated, waste across the board, kind of the whole life cycle analysis of a service organization or a manufacturing organization actually led to substantial savings. So in one's own house, so to speak, implementing green growth tactics and promulgating a kind of green-sensitive culture through the corporation turned out to be very supportive of the aggressive cost management that the post-crisis world required. And then the final stage was the recognition that in the world's now almost uniform movement toward green growth goals, there were some very significant profit opportunities. So even fairly traditional companies in things like rail transport engineered, you know, machinery and things of that sort, certainly in energy management, building materials, just a whole wide range of businesses increasingly and very aggressively oriented themselves toward producing materials, producing services that serve the needs of their industries and other industries in meeting their green growth initiatives. So we went from compliance cost view to a profit in green opportunity view in really about, I would say, 12 to 18 months' time.
It's certainly an exciting evolution. Now that people have seen that it pays to be green, you've noted that now that there's that potential profit out there, there's competition that's emerging among nations to establish leadership in green growth, manufacturing, and in the service sectors related to that. Can you tell us a little bit how the competition is playing out in both the emerging markets and more mature markets around the world?
Certainly. It's an interesting development that competition in many of the major green industries has really been elevated from the corporate level to the national level, in part because some of these technologies are so complicated or the capital required to advance products in the green space is so significant that there will be maybe one or at the very most two champions will emerge in both mature and emerging economies who will be the flag bearers for green growth. So, you know, if you look at something, for example, like high-speed rail, high-speed rail is very significant and central green growth area simply because it substitutes electricity for oil, essentially. Where high-speed rail, for example, can replace either automotive travel or aviation, you know, commercial aviation, it gives countries options in how to fuel that transportation because ultimately it's electrical. So it can be fueled by renewable energy sources, it can be fueled by whatever resources are available, coal, hydro, nuclear, anything to produce electricity. Now, the number of players in high-speed rail, significant players in high-speed rail, is actually very few. You may have five or six nationally, or five or six globally. You know, among those, I think the names are familiar, so I won't raise them. But each of those is a flag bearer for their nation, and in the effort to build out high-speed electric rail to connect cities, connect provinces and states, we're beginning to see a big focus on which of these national champions will actually emerge. You know, in a country like China, rail stock has been produced for many years by a large state-owned enterprise, and now that state-owned enterprise is orienting itself toward manufacturing the latest high technology, either dual fuel or electrical rail equipment, and they're doing a very, very good job at it. Just the other day, actually, I took a high-speed train from the city of Tianjin to the city of Beijing just 2 days ago. It's a 25-minute ride, and it's a one-hour drive. The ride is priced at 69 renminbi, which is just a little bit more than $10, and that's roughly equivalent to the tolls on the road. So that's working out very, very well for China in that regard. Same thing is true. Let me just add one thing to that. Same thing is true about things like solar energy. Emerging economies anticipate deploying a lot of solar energy, which means that they want to be in the business of manufacturing the core materials and the panels themselves, as well as all the apparatus that goes around it. And once they envision doing that for their own infrastructure use, it's an easy jump to think of this as a very important potential export item. So that those are some of the factors we see playing out now.
Ken, as governments take more and more leadership, are you seeing some trends on what divergent paths they happen to be taking? What are the differences in approach?
I would change the wording of that a little bit and say that it's not so much government taking more leadership, but the consensus that's emerging is that there's a new kind of partnership that will be very important in advancing the green growth agenda between government and business, and quite frankly, between consumers as well. So the three players in this agenda going forward, three players on the stage here. In terms of the new government-business partnership, there are really a couple of aspects to it. One is the reshaping of the regulatory landscape, and that will include regulations about energy consumption, regulations about waste disposal, regulations about environmental compliance issues, a whole range of those sorts of things, including standards and the issuance of various guidelines on new technologies, on building materials, building design, and other things that relate to energy consumption. The other part of the government role is the investment role. Because every nation's green growth goals are advanced through infrastructure investment. You know, we were talking about high-speed rail before. Obviously, high-speed rail and the laying of tracks and the extension of that technology and capability is a government responsibility. And that would be true about things like the smart grid for distribution of power. You know, whether it's direct government investment or sort of indirect use of government resources to stimulate the growth of these various infrastructure developments, kind of nets out to be the same thing. The interesting thing for me is that in thinking about a government-business partnership, different economies come at this in a different way. If you think for a moment about China, which is, you know, calls itself a socialist market economy, in China, this kind of relationship is very natural. In fact, it's very basic to the way the economy has grown. The government is in business. Business is very often part of the government. The state at the center still owns 129 of the largest enterprises, and they are the infrastructure enterprises. And then at the provincial and local level, there are tens of thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of additional businesses that are owned and somehow deeply influenced by government interests. In the United States, on the other hand, there's a degree of anxiety about the relationship between government and business, other than in the regulatory space. Even that, if you read the newspapers nowadays, there's uncertainty about which direction certain regulations are going to go. So that leads to very, very different kinds of involvements by governments. And again, to take a comparison, in countries like India and China, emerging countries generally, governments have in mind things like resource security, which is very central to their thinking. They don't want to be dependent on oil imports because they've seen what that might do to a country like the United States. They don't want to depend on food imports. They don't want to run into water crises. And so they're willing often to invest in infrastructure that may not actually ultimately be commercially viable. In other words, it's an investment often justified as a national security issue. In the U.S., if you look at something like the Department of Energy programs that are available for green growth companies, they require an application that includes a feasibility study. And that feasibility study needs to indicate how these programs eventually become commercially viable. So much of this just really is rooted in the very different economic models that we see unfolding around the world, but certainly in emerging economies, as opposed to developed economies, there's a longer-term view by governments looking at a longer-term involvement, both from investment standpoint, a tax abatement, and regulatory standpoint, in the green growth goals.
Ken, what insights would you share or recommendations for green businesses in the service and manufacturing sector over the next 6 months and beyond?
This is something we think a lot about and talk a lot about. I was just with some of our global leaders at the World Economic Forum in Tianjin, China. This is what's called the Summer Davos. One of the major topics, in fact, we had a speaker on this panel, was the topic of open innovation. And I think the first answer to your question would be to understand and to implement open innovation processes. Because in achieving the global goals, the shared global goals of green growth, it is pretty clear that the technologies that are going to be most important in almost every sector, whether you're talking about electric cars or whether you're talking about renewable energy or whether you're talking about extreme energy conservation or the design and building of energy-neutral city centers, all the way across the board. The fact is it's the technologies and the know-how for achieving these goals is not going to belong to any single company, and it's not going to even belong to any single country. And so we're really moving into an era where open innovation, which involves the broad sharing and interacting of technology developers and innovating companies that share the common goal of developing, perfecting, commercializing, and implementing the newest possible technologies will be an absolutely critical development. So I think issue number one is open innovation. Issue number two is really to rethink basic business structures, you know, recognizing that the viability of many, many companies in the future increasingly will depend on how consumers view them, not only as commercial players, but as broader influences in both the society and the physical landscape, the society and the economies in which they operate. And because of that, it's going to be increasingly important for everybody, whether you're providing services or whether you're providing goods, to think through the whole life cycle impact of what you're doing, how you use resources, how you produce things, how you demonstrate to the public that you are conscious of your responsibilities as a major economic player in the system, ultimately how the things you make are disposed of when they're no longer useful. So a full cycle life approach to designing one's businesses in the future, I think, will be an increasingly critical thing. The third and final point I would make about this is that with globalization, the dynamics of globalization, and the nature of competition we face in the world today, what we at Deloitte call global value networks are becoming more and more complicated. And because they're becoming more and more complicated, the management of these networks and the potential value of them is also growing in step with that. It means a couple of different things, and one has to do with opportunity, one has to do with risk. For opportunity, global businesses now can make products, provide services with a global footprint, in a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week business activity pattern. In doing that, they have the opportunity to support several different economies in which they function, address consumers in many, many different economies around the world that are culturally different, that are different in terms of their stage of economic development, different in terms of their needs. They also incur responsibilities in all of those countries and all those places and all those different kinds of economies. And they incur new kinds of risk. And we've been focusing a little bit on the risk because that's one of the things that we do at Deloitte. And the point I would make about this is that there are a lot of benefits in this kind of expanding and increasingly diversifying global value network. But along with it comes the risk that a brand owner or a retailer, whoever in this value chain is closest to the consumers, takes responsibility for the whole system. You may manufacture something in China, for example, sell it around the world, and although you're not manufacturing it yourself, you've outsourced it, it's part of your global value network. If there's a labor strike, if there's some sort of compliance problem, if there's an environmental spill, you assume responsibility for it in the public eye. So we have these three things. One, open innovation. Two, the reengineering of business structures to be cognizant of the broader impact that businesses have on the world. And finally, the very strategic and sophisticated management of global value networks. Those are the three keys I see in not only surviving, but in prospering in the next 6 months and beyond.
Thanks, Ken. It sounds like there's some interesting challenges for green companies coming up in the coming year. Can you tell us where to learn more about the insights that you and your group are developing?
Well, we are ramping up our publication activities, research and publication activities in China very significantly. And we are reaching out to deal with issues that are not just purely China-related, but reach across a number of emerging economies. One of our key publications is the one that you've mentioned here, Measuring Value, Profit and Green. We actually have a series called Measuring Value, which is somewhat irregularly published, but about every 3 weeks we issue one. It's electronically distributed, and we focus on issues that are of very intense current interest. We try to get a little bit deeper than media goes because we have a very large knowledge base in our firm, as you know, and we're able to aggregate a lot of different insight into some of the key issues facing the world today. So Measuring Value is available, and we're very proud, actually, of what we've been able to do with it.
Terrific. We're looking forward to reading more about your insights. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeff.
To read more about the Measuring Value series or learn more about the rest of the Deloitte 2020 podcast series, please visit www.deloitte.com/2020. That's www.deloitte.com/2020. This has been an original Deloitte Global Services Limited production. Thank you for joining us.
Deloitte refers to one or more of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu Limited, the UK private company limited by guarantee, and its network of member firms, each of which is a legally separate and independent entity. Please see www.deloitte.com/about for a detailed description of the legal structure of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu Limited and its member firms. Thank you for listening.